Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of
GF Investment Services, LLC
are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
A very good day to you all, ladies and gentlemen. This is your wake-up call coming to you from Southeast Asia, and I am your host, Richard Martin, and it is Friday, the 22nd of May, 2015. Did you hear or read about what Barack Obama said, talking a couple of weeks ago about the Trans-Pacific Partnership in a speech at the Nike factory in Oregon? Quote, "We have to make sure America writes the rules of the global economy, and we should do it today, while our economy is in a position of global strength. If we don't write the rules for trade around the world, guess what? China will. And they'll write those rules in a way that gives Chinese workers and Chinese businesses the upper hand." End of obscene quote. Well, those very few words of Obama's are to date his most widely circulated PR effort to garner support for the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership, and they are thoroughly representative of the thinking of America's imperial elite. They are so revealing, so wrong, and so dangerous on so many levels that, quite frankly, one scarcely knows where to begin. In fact, they carry the seeds of America's destruction, and obviously they're focused on China. First, the arrogance and hegemonic intent of the statement is astonishing, even though it's become routine for the U.S. elite. Who can tell me what gives the United States, a country of 300 million on the opposite side of the vast Pacific, the right to determine the rules of trade for East Asia, which includes China, a country of 1.3 billion people? The U.S. can no longer assert that privilege based on its economic power, since its gross GDP, measured in purchasing power parity, is now, according to the IMF, second to China's. Clear evidence of the relative power of the Chinese and American economies was the world's reaction to China's launch of the long-overdue Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIIB, to provide development funds for Asia and beyond. The level of funding necessary for such development has long been denied by the U.S.-dominated World Bank and the IMF. U.S. allies, even the U.K. and Israel, stumbled over one another to join the AIIB, despite U.S. bullying. To try to stop them leaving the U.S. and its cat's paw in East Asia, Japan out in the cold. Even more amazing is the idea that the U.S. thinks it can write the rules of trade for China and East Asia. Given the new economic realities, that day is past. Indeed, Obama, perhaps unwittingly in his desperation to sell the measure by frightening us into acceptance of it, acknowledges this fact. What else can he mean when he says, "We should do it, i.e. pass the TPP, today, while our economy is in a position of global strength"? Look at what he's saying implicitly about the situation tomorrow. Second, there is a win-lose mentality run rampant in Obama's words, and this is the most horrifying part of this statement. Simply put, Americans write the rules for their benefit and to the detriment of others. Or, others write the rules to the same end for themselves. This is no longer a viable view of the world. For where does that view end? It ends in conflict and then domination and submission, the struggle, economic and otherwise, of each against all. In the 21st century and beyond, with a world rife with high-tech weapons of unimaginable power, such conflict will produce untold suffering and death for billions, if not the end of the human race as we know it. Simply banning the supply of such weapons will not be enough, because they can always be recreated. There is no permanent technical fix, only a temporary one, no matter what the nuke abolitionists might like to think. This is why I'm so pessimistic about the future. America is hell-bent on hegemony, failing which it will purposely bring down the entire world. It is the classic warmonger's song. We're going to keep what we've got and build on it. And if we can't, then we'll make sure no one else can either. This is bound to end in tears. Bound. There is no way around this, ladies and gentlemen. This view is quite the opposite from the outlook of the Chinese, which is tirelessly about creating win-win situations, not win-lose. Not you are either for us or against us, but win-win. Read China Daily, as you should for some sense of balance, or any of the outlets from China, and you will find the win-win philosophy ever present. The Chinese are clearly onto something here. In that direction lies the possibility, not the guarantee, but the possibility of peace, prosperity, and development for the planet. In the direction pointed to by Obama and the U.S. imperial elite lies what we have witnessed throughout the Middle East and North Africa, and now since the U.S. instigated coup in Ukraine. The people of East Asia, including Japan, should be wary of the U.S. siren call to make one or another of them the co-winner in the region. In fact, Obama's call to write the rules of trade or anything else should be a warning to the people of East Asia and elsewhere. The conclusion for them is that if the U.S. decides it must write the rules to contain them or put them down, then eventually, so it will be. By that very statement, the U.S. forfeits its claim to leadership in the world. By that very statement, the U.S. is telling the world that every nation is dispensable except its own. Third, rarely mentioned in the objections to TPP among U.S. progressives, is its role as an instrument of imperial domination. True, as these people say, the TPP is not meant to help U.S. workers, as Obama would have you believe. It is a corporate giveaway. It is a secret, and therefore very anti-democratic agreement. There should be no doubt about any of this. Members of Congress get to see at least some aspects of the TPP as it's being written, but they may not bring aides or experts with them as they view the deep, dark secrets of the agreement. They may not take notes or make copies of the text. They may not reveal its contents to the public. And so we, the people, are totally excluded from any knowledge of what lies in the TPP. Nothing could be further from the democracy or transparency that the imperial elite likes to claim as its hallmark. In contrast, one can be certain that the rich and powerful, whether Nike executives or the international banksters, know all they need to about the TPP and have extraordinary influence over it. But such considerations are all about Americans and their local rulers. Such considerations leave out the questions of war and peace and the reality of U.S. empire, a phrase that rarely passes the lips of mainstream progressives. Ladies and gentlemen, you must continue to work to stop the TPP. But be aware that this battle is not simply about a few more goodies for Americans. The TPP is, in fact, one more step on the road to Armageddon, which the U.S. seems to be pawing with some measure of desperation and panic. All right, well, very quickly, I give you my information, which consists of an email and a phone number. And the email is rm@gfawd.com. That's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Let me give you that once more. rm@gfawd.com. And my phone number, in case you would like to call me in private to talk about your financial situations, I should be very glad for you to do so. And all you have to do is call the number in Sarasota, Florida, and you will come through loud and clear to me in Southeast Asia, wherever I may happen to be. And the number to call is area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's an area code in Sarasota, Florida at 941-441-1682. Now, that number is a regular phone number. It is not one of these weird numbers which charge you $34.99 for every minute. I'm afraid I'm not in that business. I might wish I was, but fate didn't lead me there. So, anyway, call the number 941-441-1682 if you'd like some help with your financial affairs. Otherwise, we will talk twice a week in the normal way, and you will get your emails if you're subscribed to them in the normal way. And I hope you are learning something and you are, above all, being prepared for the horrors that are headed our way. All right. Well, I'm going to read you the text of a report about the TPP by Michael Wessel, who is a cleared liaison to two statutory advisory committees and who was a commissioner on the U.S. Trade Deficit Review Commission, as well as the International Trade Co-Chair for the Kerry Edwards presidential campaign. You need to tell me what's wrong with this trade agreement, not one that was passed 25 years ago, a frustrated President Barack Obama recently complained about criticisms of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. He's right. The public criticisms of the TPP have been vague. That's by design. Anyone who has read the text of the agreement could be jailed for disclosing its contents. I've actually read the TPP text provided to the government's own advisors, and I've given the president an earful about how this trade deal will damage this nation. But I can't share my criticisms with you. I can tell you that Elizabeth Warren is right about her criticism of the trade deal. We should be very concerned about what's written in this trade deal, and particularly how the Obama administration is keeping information secret even from those of us who are supposed to provide advice. So-called cleared advisors, like me, are prohibited from sharing publicly the criticisms we've lodged about specific proposals and approaches. The government has created a perfect catch-22. The law prohibits us from talking about the specifics of what we've seen, allowing the president to criticize us for not being specific. Instead of simply admitting that he disagrees with me and with many other cleared advisers about the merits of the TPP, the president instead pretends that our specific pointed criticisms don't exist. What I can tell you is that the administration is being unfair to those who are raising proper questions about the harms the TPP would do. To the administration, everyone who questions their approach is branded as a protectionist or worse, dishonest. They broadly criticize organized labor, despite the fact that unions have been the primary force in America pushing for strong rules to promote opportunity and jobs. And they dismiss individuals like me who believe that, first and foremost, a trade agreement should promote the interests of domestic producers and their employees. I've been deeply involved in trade policy for almost four decades. For 21 years, I worked for former Democratic leader Richard Gephardt and handled all trade policy issues, including Fast Track, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the World Trade Organization's Uruguay Round, which is the largest trade agreement in history. I am also a consultant to various domestic producers and the United Steelworkers Union, for whom I served as a cleared advisor on two trade advisory committees. To top it off, I was a publicly acknowledged advisor to the Obama campaign in 2008. Obama may no longer be listening to my advice, but Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren might as well be. Warren, of course, has been perhaps the deal's most vocal critic, but even the more cautious Clinton has raised the right questions on what a good TPP would look like. Her spokesman, Nick Merrill, said, "She will be watching closely to see what is being done to crack down on currency manipulation, improve labor rights, protect the environment and health, promote transparency, and open new opportunities for our small businesses to export overseas." As she warned in her book, Hard Choices, we shouldn't be giving special rights to corporations at the expense of workers and consumers. On this count, the current TPP doesn't measure up. And nothing being considered by Congress right now would ensure that the TPP meets the goal of promoting domestic production and job creation. The text of the TPP, like all trade deals, is a closely guarded secret. The fact, or rather that fact, makes a genuine public debate impossible, and should make robust debate behind closed doors all the more essential. But the ability of TPP critics like me to point out the deal's many failings is limited by the government's surprising and unprecedented refusal to make revisions to the language in the TPP fully available to cleared advisers. During the debate on NAFTA, as a cleared advisor for the Democratic leadership, I had a copy of the entire text in a safe next to my desk and regularly was briefed on specifics of the negotiations, including counterproposals made by Mexico and Canada. During the TPP negotiations, the United States Representative, USTR, has never shared proposals being advanced by other TPP partners. Today's consultations are in many ways much more restrictive than those under past administrations. All advisors and any liaisons are required to have security clearances, which entail extensive paperwork and background investigations, before they are able to review text and participate in briefings. But despite clearances and the statutory duty to provide advice, advisors do not have access to all the materials that a reasonable person would need to do the job. The negotiators provide us with proposals, but those are merely initial proposals to trading partners. We are not allowed to see counter-proposals from our trading partners. Often, advisors are provided with updates indicating that the final text will balance all appropriate stakeholder interests, but we frequently receive few additional details beyond that flimsy assurance. Those details have enormous repercussions. For instance, rules of origin specify how much of a product must originate within the TPP countries for the resulting product to be eligible for duty-free treatment. These are complex rules that decide where a company will manufacture its products and where it will purchase raw materials. Under the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, 62.5% of a car needed to originate within NAFTA countries. In the US-Australia Free Trade Agreement, it was lowered to 50%. It further dropped to 35% in the US-Korea Free Trade Agreement, KORUS, K-O-R-U-S. In essence, under our agreement with Korea, 65% of a car from South Korea could be made from Chinese parts and still qualify for duty-free treatment when exported to the US. That fact is politically toxic, and for that reason, we should expect the TPP agreement to have higher standards. But will it reach the 62.5% NAFTA requirement? Or will it be only a slight improvement over KORUS? Without access to the final text of the agreement, it's impossible to say. State-owned enterprises may, for the first time, be addressed in the TPP. But once again, the details are not clear. Will exemptions be provided to countries like Vietnam, Malaysia, or Singapore, all of which could be heavily impacted by such a rule? What will be the test to determine what is or is not acceptable behavior? Will injury be required to occur over a substantial period of time? Or will individual acts of non-commercial damaging trade practices be actionable? Again, it's impossible to say for sure. Advisors are almost flying blind on these questions and others. Only portions of the text have been provided to be read under the watchful eye of a USTR official. Access, up until recently, was provided on secure websites. But the government-run website does not contain the most up-to-date information for cleared advisors. To get that information, we have to travel to certain government facilities and sign in to read the materials. Even then, the administration determines what we can and cannot review, and often they provide carefully edited summaries rather than the actual underlying text, which is critical to really understanding the consequences of the agreement. Cleared advisors were created by statute to advise our nation's trade negotiations. There is a hierarchical structure, starting with the USTR's Advisory Committee on Trade Policy and Negotiations at the top, a committee that includes people like Steelworkers President Leo Gerard, MasterCard CEO A.J. Banger, Etsy CEO Chad Dickerson, and Jill Apple, co-owner of Apple's pork farms. Then there are specific committees covering subjects like labor, the environment, and agriculture that makes up the next tier. The last tier consists of the Industry Trade Advisory Committees, or PACs, which focus on individual sectors such as steel and aerospace. At last count, there were more than 600 cleared advisors. The vast majority of them represent business interests. In an effort to diminish criticism, USTR is now letting cleared advisors review summaries of what the negotiators have done. In response to a question about when the full updated text will be made available, we've been told, "We are working on and making them available as soon as possible." That's not the case overseas. Our trading partners have this text, but the government's own cleared advisors, serving on statutorily created advisory committees, are kept in the dark. How can we properly advise without knowing the details? Questions pervade virtually every chapter of the proposed agreement, including labor and the environment, investor state, intellectual property, and others. The answers to these questions affect the sourcing and investment decisions of our companies and result in jobs for our people. Our elected representatives would be abdicating their constitutional duty if they failed to raise questions. Senator Warren should be commended for her courage in standing up to the president, and Secretary Clinton for raising a note of caution, and I encourage all elected officials to raise these important questions. Working Americans can't afford more failed trade agreements and trailed policies. Congress should refuse to pass fast-track trade negotiating authority until the partnership between the branches and the trust of the American people is restored. That will require a lot of fence mending and disclosure of exactly what the TPP will do. That begins by sharing the final text of the TPP with those of us who won't simply rubber stamp it. Excellent article, I feel, ladies and gentlemen, and that came from Michael Wessel. So I strongly suggest that you take him very seriously, read whatever it is he has to say about this, and do ask questions. Whatever you do, don't leave things out here, because if you don't ask questions, nobody will. And few people are asking questions. I actually am somewhat leery of what he has to say about Clinton, because Clinton is standing on the fence. Clinton is not prepared to come down one side or another on this issue. So I'm not quite sure what his game plan is in supporting the premises of Hillary Clinton, but they're not good, and I would not go along with anything that she may say. It is my intention to persuade you that whoever you do decide to vote for, stay away from this woman. She's bad news, and she'll do great harm to the country. Anyway, that's a discussion for another day. I want you to consider for a moment an aspect of employment, or unemployment, I should say, that is the result of what you do every day, thereby taking work away from someone who previously had it. Technology has knocked the bottom rung out of the employment ladder, which has sent youth unemployment around the globe skyrocketing and presented us with a serious economic dilemma. Many focus on the poor state of the educational system or the jobless recovery, but another overlooked factor behind this trend is the phenomenon of what we may call shadow work. Shadow work is all the unpaid jobs we do on behalf of businesses and organizations. Think about it. We pump our own gas, scan our own groceries, book our travel, and bus our tables at Starbucks. Shadow work is a new concept, so as yet no one has compiled economic data on how many jobs we, the consumers, have taken over from erstwhile employees. Yet it is most certainly a force shrinking the job market, and the unemployment it creates is structural. Thanks in part to this new phenomenon, further widespread joblessness could become entrenched in the social landscape. Consider what you now do yourself. You bank on your cell phone, check yourself out at CVS or the grocery store without ever speaking to an employee, book your own flights, and print your own boarding pass at the airport or online without ever talking to a ticket agent. And that's just in the last few years. Imagine what's coming next. In the modern economy, there is no bigger issue than jobs and the cost of maintaining a staff. For the vast majority of businesses, schools, and non-profits, personnel is the largest budget item. This includes, of course, both salaries and benefits. The latter were once called fringe benefits, though the term fringe disappeared as the category outgrew anything resembling a fringe. Hiring, training, and supervising employees augment the cost of personnel, and another outlay kicks in when workers retire: pensions, annuities, and, for some employers, the gigantic healthcare costs that pile up from retirement until the end of life, which has become a lengthy period as lifespans stretch into the 80s and 90s. In recent years, salaries in real dollars have either remained static or dropped for most of the labor force. But the galloping cost of benefits, one rule of thumb pegs them at 40% of salary, has put steady pressure on employers. Healthcare expenses in particular have driven up this line item. In the United States, healthcare has become an enormous, seemingly uncontrollable sector, swelling relentlessly and growing far faster than the rest of the economy, much as cancer grows without relationship to neighboring cells. Short of a seismic change like universal single-payer health insurance with price controls on drugs and procedures, the upward pressure on employee benefits will continue. The upshot is a strong incentive to replace full-time employees with part-time outsourced overseas or contract workers who receive no benefits. Better yet, simply lay people off or hand off jobs to customers as shadow work. Historically, automation has eliminated jobs at the point of production, for example, in factories. Shadow work instead deletes jobs at the point of sale, for example, at drugstore checkouts. As I said, there are no hard data on this yet, but one thing we do know is that the points of sale vastly outnumber points of production. The development of ever more sophisticated technologies only fuels the growth of new forms of shadow work, as it enables consumers to do more kinds of jobs and more cheaply. ATMs arrived decades ago, but today Customers can do much of their banking with a handheld device. Shadow work is squeezing out entry-level jobs that have launched countless careers. These jobs at the base of the economic pyramid pay little, but lay the foundation for everything that rises above them. And as with any structure, when the foundation crumbles, the superstructure may collapse as well. Entry-level jobs provide more than a paycheck. They are the sidewalk of the workplace, the platform that allows entry to all businesses on Main Street. Okay, well, as you probably know, in a serious new escalation of tensions between China and the United States in the South China Sea, China's Navy on Wednesday demanded on 8 occasions that an American surveillance plane in the South China Sea leave the area immediately. The surveillance plane was swooping over man-made islands that the Chinese military has created with the apparent intention of building military bases in international waters. The surveillance mission was top secret, but the confrontation was revealed because a CNN reporter had been granted permission to join in the surveillance flight. The surveillance plan was the U.S. Navy's new Boeing P-8A Poseidon anti-submarine patrol aircraft. According to the Navy, the new aircraft, quote-unquote, will transform the way the service performs its anti-submarine warfare, ASW, anti-surface warfare, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance missions for broad area, maritime, and littoral operations. Last year, you may remember, a Chinese jet fighter made several passes as close as 30 feet to a U.S. surveillance plane in international waters. The incident was reminiscent of an April 2001 encounter when a Chinese F-8 interceptor smashed into a U.S. surveillance aircraft in international waters in the South China Sea. The Chinese aircraft crashed into the sea and its crew was killed. The U.S. plane made an emergency landing on China's Hainan Island and its 24 crew members were imprisoned for 10 days. The U.S. has announced that the U.S. military will use its aircraft and naval ships to confront China directly in the South China Sea. The U.S. is conducting its surveillance flights over international waters, but China is claiming that it has sovereignty over the entire South China Sea, meaning that regions have been international waters for centuries that are now being claimed as Chinese sovereign waters. What we're seeing is the kind of tit-for-tat escalation that leads to full-scale war during the generational crisis era when nationalism and xenophobia are at their highest. At some point, as actions escalate, one side or the other will, by miscalculation, by accident, or by intention, take a military action that requires a response. And then things are almost sure to spiral quickly out of control. Very grim, ladies and gentlemen. Very grim. Very grim indeed. Now, come down to Houston, says William Snyder, leader of the Deloitte Corporate Restructuring Group. You'll see there is just a stream of consultants and bankruptcy attorneys running around this town. But it's not just in Houston or in the oil patch. It's in retail, healthcare, mining, finance. Bankruptcies are suddenly booming after years of drought. In the first quarter, 26 publicly traded corporations filed for bankruptcy, up from 11 at the same time last year, according to data from bankruptcydata.com. Six of these companies listed assets of over $1 billion, the most since financial crisis year 2009. In total, they listed $34 billion in assets, the second highest for the first quarter since before the financial crisis, behind only the record $102 billion in 2009. The largest bankruptcy was the casino operating company of Caesars Entertainment. Next in line were Doral Financial, securities services firm Integrity, Radio Shack, and Allied Nevada Gold. The first oil and gas company showed up in sixth place, Quicksilver Resources. It joined privately owned natural gas drillers in crushing their investors. Among the largest 15 sinners on the list are five more oil and gas related companies, but all clustered in the lower half. This isn't the list of a single troubled sector that ran out of luck. This isn't a single issue, such as the oil price collapse. It's a broader phenomenon. Too much debt across a struggling economy. And now the reckoning has started. The list only contains publicly traded companies that have already filed. But the energy sector, for example, is full of companies that are owned by private equity firms, such as natural gas driller Sampson Resources, which warned in March that it might resort to bankruptcy to restructure its debt. Similar troubles are building up in other sectors. While stockholders get wiped out and creditors at the lower end of the capital structure lose their shirts, restructuring specialists like Snyder in Houston are flourishing. For years, the Fed's flood of money kept these companies afloat, no matter how badly they were leaking. Now reality is settling in. For restructuring specialists, opportunity has finally arrived. Corporate bankruptcies are at one end of the spectrum. And the other end? Well, the Fed is so worried that it conducted a workshop evocatively named Chapter 9 and Alternatives for Distressed Municipalities and States, during which the New York Fed, President William Dudley, warned about municipal bankruptcies. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it should come as no surprise that the U.S. is a net immigration country, while China and Mexico are both net emigration countries. What may be a surprise is that now China has overtaken Mexico as the top importer of immigrants. The flood of money from China into key cities has been nothing short of breathtaking. China is undergoing a massive expansion in their country and all of the challenges that come with exponential growth. For most in the public, they simply have no idea that China is now the biggest importer, or immigrants to the U.S. now overtaking Mexico. This is a fascinating trend and something that is largely ignored in the media. The U.S. has recently seen a very strong dollar, and this has taken an impact on its own domestic manufacturing sector. A stronger dollar makes U.S. goods less competitive in the global stage. As the low-wage race to the bottom continues, many are leaving economies where the booms are uneven. For those living in cities like New York, San Francisco, or Miami, foreign money flowing into real estate markets is no surprise. But the overall numbers are telling. Mexico is usually perceived as a major net importer of immigrants to the U.S., usually the largest. By proximity and the struggles of Mexico economically, it's no surprise that many leave Mexico for better prospects, which makes the trend of China being America's top importer of immigrants a big surprise. A massive ocean divides the two countries, and the process to get to the U.S. isn't as simple as you may think. But having financial resources allows many easier methods out. The U.S. is consistently a net importer of immigrants, It's part of its makeup. The U.S. is a nation of immigrants. But it's fascinating to see where people are coming from. Also, immigrants from China are likely coming from situations of better means. Whether or not this is a good thing depends on where you're coming from. In many places like San Francisco, properties are being bought up as investments and prices are much more expensive for locals than they would otherwise be. This is part of being in a global economy. Well, globalization is a failed business strategy, at least in the way most corporations pursue it. The theory sounds compelling. Lower manufacturing costs abroad are supposed to reduce prices for American consumers while raising the standard of living in foreign countries whose consumers would then buy American goods. The process has broken down at that last step, however. According to Robert Salomon, a professor of international management at the NYU Stern School of Business, and I quote, "Even for the most successful multinationals, profit margins in international markets are on average lower than margins in the domestic market. It's the liability of foreign markets. By virtue of the fact that you are foreign, you are at a disadvantage." End of quote. Tastes and preferences vary by culture. Rarely will people on two different continents want to buy the same goods in the same way. Yet executives persist in assuming their product is a hammer and each new market is simply another nail. This is a problem even for relatively similar cultures. Target, for instance, recently closed its Canadian locations to refocus on the U.S. market. If leaping that barrier is problematic, then Target is certainly not likely to succeed in Germany or China. It is better off not trying. Small businesses seem to have better luck playing both sides. Chinese restaurants in the U.S., for instance, often have two menus. American customers can choose from semi-Chinese cuisine adapted to American tastes. Chinese-American customers get the real Chinese food menu with selections that are more traditional. Anti-trade government policies don't help. Free trade agreements like TPP never deliver truly free trade. Inevitably, they devolve into a giant set of compromises. Even proponents usually sell them as not perfect but better than nothing. Agreements like NAFTA and TPP don't respond to this concern and are certainly not better than nothing. Even if all legal trade impediments miraculously disappeared, businesses would still have to find ways to serve culturally different markets while preserving economies of scale. The evidence suggests this is harder than it seems, but some would surely succeed. Yet we don't have such a world. Instead, would-be importers and exporters must navigate a dense and constantly shifting legal patchwork. This inevitably favors those who find ways to carve out their own private pathways. In most cases, the so-called trade agreements serve mainly to offer false hope. Gullible business owners believe the hype and make poor decisions. The business lesson seems to be that, short of truly free trade for all, smart companies stay close to home. The political lesson is, or should be, that you can't be halfway free. Freedom demands total commitment. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, let's top it off with some emails that have come my way in the last few days, starting with Hugh, who says, "Dear Richard, After reading your email on the self-employed, all I could think of are those 97% who could have benefited from small loans for tools, equipment, extra space, etc., but weren't worthy of the Federal Reserve's largesse. The article in today's New York Times, citing the uptick in financial industry wages and office rentals, only disgusted me more. Regards, Hugh. Well, I get your point, Hugh, and you're absolutely right. What more can I say? Right, well, Steve Kruger weighed in with this. Thanks for devoting some time to the nightmare that is Chicago. Chicago is a prime example of what happens when politicians buy the votes of public sector employees by promising them the moon, only to find out that the moon is undeliverable. Chicago is the motherlode of corruption in government. Four of Illinois' last seven governors are currently sitting in prison. And that includes the mop-headed Governor Blagojevich, convicted for trying to sell Senator Obama's Senate seat. How's that for entrepreneurial spirit? And now our two-term Obama said he will be building his presidential library in Chicago. I have to ask, just what could the worst president America ever had fill this library up with? He has not come up with a birth certificate in 8 years. Both he and his wife surrendered their license to practice law without any explanation and, oh yes, a Nobel Peace Prize that may be recalled. He could save the nation millions on the library and just rent a side room at a Holiday Inn. Steve Kruger. Oh, Steve, I am so proud of you that you should think of us, the lowly listeners at the wake-up call, to propound your worldly wisdom. Thanks a lot, mate. Right, Floyd has an email for us as follows. Richard, in a not-too-recent show, you talked about the sorry state of literacy and numeracy in the United States, where we are near the bottom by most measures and dead last in some areas. And the situation only seems to be getting worse over time. Could it be then that this dumbing down is intentional? A well-educated American college grad would conceivably command a premium salary in fields such as engineering and medicine. And businesses would be pretty much compelled to pay such a salary. But a dumbed-down American graduate of an online diploma mill would command no such premium, and businesses, citing the dearth of qualified applicants, would be forced to resort to H-1B applicants from India, China, etc. And those applicants, being virtual indentured servants, would take whatever pittance was offered to them and do. Is this dumbing down a vast conspiracy? Don't ask me. I'm a product of American schools. Cheers, Floyd. Oh, Floyd, I don't think it's a dumbing down of a vast conspiracy. I'm afraid it's just stupidity with a capital S. You know, nobody knows what to do anywhere in the United States anymore. I think the country's run out of qualified genius immigrants, and it's now sort of floundering in the mud. I think that's what's going on. I think that's behind the ultimate decline of the United States, is that not enough qualified, intelligent people are prepared to take positions of responsibility and do what has to be done in order to turn the country back up on a course of economic growth again. I mean, when you look at some of these leaders and you look at some of the political leaders and you ask yourself, what the hell do they have to offer? Answers, frankly, are not forthcoming. I really don't think it's a conspiracy, Floyd. I think it's just downright simple, absolute, arrant, utter stupidity at work. Well, 2 weeks ago, Russia celebrated the 70th anniversary of V-Day over Nazi Germany with the traditional huge military parade in Moscow. However, this year, the celebrations were marred by the fact that many Western political leaders decided to stay away from Moscow in protest over the Ukraine situation. This snub seems quite churlish when one considers that Russia made the biggest sacrifices by far in World War II. Roughly 27 million Russians lost their lives between 1941 and 1945, as opposed to 139,000 US killed in the European theater. Russia accounted for nearly 80% of all Allied war casualties. Moreover, without Russia's participation in the war, Hitler might well have ended up winning it. Eventually, the political and economic system the Nazis had erected would have crashed and burned anyway, but without the expansion of the war to a second front, it would have been very difficult and costly to dislodge the Germans from the territories that they had conquered. And yet, despite all this, Western representatives ignored the celebrations. Obama's remarks on the 70th anniversary of Germany's surrender mentioned only U.S. forces. In contrast, Putin expressed gratitude to, quote-unquote, the peoples of Great Britain, France, and the United States of America for their contribution to the victory. Very, very sobering, if you ask me. And even if you don't. The mayhem and destruction of World War II should forever stand as a stark warning. War brings nothing but sorrow, usually both for the victors and the vanquished. The average citizen has nothing to gain from supporting a warmongering political leadership. The emotional attachment to one's country shouldn't blind one to the fact that war is the health of the state, as Randolph Bourne has so trenchantly put it. It is highly detrimental to everybody else's health. America has not learnt the lessons of the past. They are too busy complaining about the antics of the likes of John McCain and his henchmen. We should be far more concerned about the silent and not so silent assent of the average American. Sadly, there is no way out of this situation. These men want war. They will have the war they want. And the little flags will go up again on the cars, and the Americans will rally round. You, my faithful listeners, have truly one alternative, and only one alternative, escape. Do it while there's still time. And by the way, Monday's show should be a very interesting show for you. I will keep tabs on it, keep it a well-guarded secret until Monday, but you might all want to listen in because you might have something waiting for you that might interest you very greatly indeed. And so with that, ladies and gentlemen, I hope that on Monday, by the way, I will have my new recording equipment ready up and running, and so lots of new and good things should happen on that date. But in the meantime, this is Richard Martin at the White Wake Up Call, wishing you a wonderful weekend. Until Monday, take care. Bye-bye for now.